It's a cold case that has haunted Iowa for 39 years. This hour, how DNA and a composite image led police this week to charge a man with murder. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In a moment, conversation with Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German about this week's first-degree murder charge in the death of a young woman at Westdale Mall back in 1979. Also, I'll talk with Tony Lays of the Des Moines Register about enrollment in the Affordable Care Act by Iowans and two Iowa middle schools requiring students to take a gun safety course this spring. I'll talk with the superintendent. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Is 1979 in your living memory? It was a long time ago. Jimmy Carter was our president, Robert Ray our governor. In December of 79, we were about a month into that Iranian hostage crisis. Also in 1979, here in Iowa, in December, 18-year-old Michelle Martinko was found stabbed to death in the parking lot of Westdale Mall in Cedar Rapids. This week, 39 years to the day after her death, Cedar Rapids police arrested a suspect. Jerry Lynn Burns of Manchester, Iowa, has been charged with first-degree murder in the death. Burns made his initial appearance in court yesterday.
Jerry Burns, you've been accused of the crime of murder in the first degree in violation of Iowa Code sections 707.1 and 707.2 sub 1 sub A. It's alleged that on or about December 19, 1979, in Linn County in the state of Iowa, with malice aforethought, willfully, deliberately, and with premeditation, killed Michelle Martinko at 2600 Edgewood Road Southwest in Linn County, Iowa.
Sir, this charge is a Class A felony.
The judge agreed to set his bond at $5 million in cash. Prosecutors called him a flight risk. Burns is currently being held in the Linn County Jail. Joining us now to talk about this nearly four-decade-old case, Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German. It's a pleasure to have you on the program again. Wayne German, thank you for joining us.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me.
Give us, perhaps as a start, the chronology of this case, the milestones in the investigation. Tell us first about the circumstances of Michelle Martinko's death in 1979.
Okay. In December 1979, the evening of the 19th, Michelle went to Westdale Mall to shop for a winter coat. She was last seen about 6:30 p.m. and to do that. When she did not arrive home at 2 in the morning, the following morning, which is December 20th, her parents called the Cedar Rapids police to report her missing. Police officers began to search, and at about 4 a.m., a patrol officer located the family's vehicle at the Westdale Mall. And inside the vehicle, they found Michelle and discovered that she had been a victim of a homicide and been brutally stabbed. So the investigation proceeded like many homicide investigations. Friends, associates are all interviewed. Information is tried to get obtained. Also, related to the investigation, the vehicle and the crime scene is thoroughly processed for all types of evidence. And the evidence is submitted for analysis. It's also packaged and stored because the evidence will be needed for future prosecutions of cases once persons are identified as and arrested and charged.
Mm-hmm. So this 1972 Buick Electra that she was found dead in has been stored all this time?
I don't know the correct answer for that. I can certainly check on exactly what has happened with the vehicle, but I do know it was thoroughly processed for forensic and latent evidence.
Investigators in your department say there are no signs of robbery, sexual assault. What do we think happened?
Well, that's part of the investigation that, again, is Mr. Vanderson and the county attorney and his office is looking over. There's about 11,000 pages of documents and material that need to be reviewed. So I really cannot get into theories, possible motives or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, before we get to the breakthrough, the DNA collection and so forth, when was this case at a low point? When was it declared unsolved and perhaps unsolvable, a cold case?
I don't have the exact date that all the leads were exhausted and the investigators who were primarily assigned or, suspended that part of the investigation. But all leads were thoroughly looked at. And between December of 79 up to the present day, any information regarding the case that came to our attention was explored thoroughly to either verify, confirm, or discount the involvement or the information if it was or was not related to the case itself.
Mm-hmm. When was the first inkling that investigators had evidence to perhaps link them to a suspect? When did it become hot again, this cold case?
Well, I think we need to go back to 2006 when DNA and what there was a profile developed from some of the forensic evidence, and a DNA profile was developed and submitted into the national database of CODIS. So that's when some stronger light. People had some renewed hope that a profile was developed and put into a national database that contains a plethora of individuals whose DNA is also in there. But I guess that those hopes, were I don't want to say extinguished, but when there was no immediate hit or match, we kind of were looking at other options. I know a number of investigators and officers who have since retired and left the department did put in hundreds and if not thousands of hours between December of 79 up until about 4 years ago. And the case was renewed by investigator Matt Enlinger, who is an active duty investigator, a member of our criminal investigations division. He took on the case and wanted to explore some new options and alternatives. We do have a cold case unit that he is a member of, along with a couple of retired Cedar Rapids officers. One in particular who was here when I arrived in October 2012 was a retired captain, Jeff Melgren. So I know he worked it, along with a current volunteer, who J.D. Smith, who is a retired DCI agent and also a former public safety commissioner when Cedar Rapids had the commission form of government. He was also joining in the investigation and is still a part of the investigation, along with retired Lieutenant Ken Washburn. Primarily now, since Captain Melgren, he moved out of state, so he was no longer directly involved in the investigation, but I do know he was involved in it, this and other cold cases. But Denlinger, Smith, and Washburn, with Denlinger really taking the lead, renewed the investigation somewhere 3 or 4 years ago.
If you've just joined us, Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German is my guest, talking about the breakthrough in a 39-year-old case in the death of an 18-year-old woman in Cedar Rapids. So that DNA collected in 2006, when was the next real breakthrough?
Well, the DNA actually was collected in 79. The profile was identified in 2006, mm-hmm. and submitted into CODIS. The next big breakthrough, Investigator Denlinger became aware of a company in Reston, Virginia, Parabon, and in May of 2017, we reached out to Parabon to ask them to, with the profile and through the DNA sample, to develop the physical characteristics, because that's what Parabon is one of their specialties that they have the capabilities of doing. So in May of 2017, that was done. They produced those sketches that were released to the media and went really nationwide. In hopes of generating fresh leads, tips, or information from anyone who saw the presentation in May and may have information related to the December 79 homicide.
This is really amazing, Chief German, that you can take someone's DNA, and I guess we're going to eye color, facial structure, hair color, pigmentation perhaps, to draw up an image. That's what's happened.
Yeah, that was, it really was amazing back in May of 17 when Parabon came out and participated with the press conference with this new development, and what they produced is really amazing. And I know we're not the only police department who has done this, but what they have the capabilities of doing with DNA is just truly amazing. Mm-hmm. So through this effort in May of 17, there were over between 100 and 200 tips and leads that this presentation generated, and that's what Investigator Denlinger and the cold case unit spent the next several months working all of these tips and leads.
Mm-hmm. A lot of long hours of work. How was it narrowed down to this one individual, this suspect, Jerry Lynn Burns, and how was his DNA connected, collected and connected with the DNA that was found in the car of Michelle Martinko?
Well, through information provided by Parabon, the investigators were able to, narrow where the DNA originated from. And again, I can't get into specific facts of the investigations. That will come out in time, but some other covert or DNA was obtained covertly and, again, submitted to the DCI laboratory for analysis, and that DNA matched the DNA that was obtained from the crime scene in 1979.
For those not completely acquainted with DNA matching, what are the chances there is another explanation for Jerry Burns' DNA being in that car?
Yeah, the chances that we were advised of, that the male DNA profile that was developed from that stain that was obtained is fewer than 1 in 100 billion, that's with a B, unrelated individuals would have the same profile. So, Ken, I don't know how many zeros follow a billion, but...
That's a big number.
Yeah, and it was pretty significant and very telling. So once that information came back, that's where the effort and plans and strategies were put into place. All along, especially the last 18 months, for sure, we've been working closely with the Linn County Attorney's Office to make sure every step of the way that the actions we were taking were going to be legal and proper and in accordance with the what they would need to achieve a successful prosecution. Mm-hmm. So,
Chief German, I know there's a lot you can't talk about, and that's understandable. But here, what can you tell us about the arrest of Jerry Burns, his initial appearance, his behavior, how he is facing these charges?
Yeah, Mr. Burns has been arrested and charged. We go and pursue the evidence, and we go where the evidence leads us. So, I know he is in the Linn County Jail for now. His initial appearance was yesterday. He's got another appearance next week. And he was interviewed on Wednesday by police, and I am not aware of any other subsequent interview or contact with Mr. Burns since he was taken into jail.
Mm-hmm. Does he have an explanation for how his DNA could be in that car?
On the interview Wednesday, no. He was not able to provide an explanation as to why his DNA was inside that vehicle.
Mm-hmm. What is the atmosphere like among your officers there at the Cedar Rapids Police? Just trying to think of what it must be like after nearly four decades and this cold case, finally finding some resolution. We think relief, celebration. How would you describe it?
I think it's a little bit of everything. Honestly, everybody was relieved that a 39-year-old unsolved homicide was still a case was still out there. Elated because I think the Martinko family and the residents, all throughout Cedar Rapids and Iowa and throughout the country, we've been contacted from people who were here in Cedar Rapids in 79 and lived through this and felt and experienced the fear. This city, the community was haunted by what occurred in December of 79. So I think by having this level of resolution right now that this case has been solved and we're going to move forward as, a big plus for everyone in this community. But, I can't say it enough. The men and women of this police department never gave up. From December of 79 up till this past Wednesday, and we're going to continue to move forward to do whatever needs to be done to arrive at a successful prosecution. But and this is just one case that shows the dedication and commitment of the men and women of this department. They do what needs to be done, what the community expects of them, and they're truly amazing individuals that I'm really honored to be fortunate enough to work with.
And finally, Police Chief German, this has garnered, as you well know, more than anyone, so much national attention here. How unusual is this, after such a long time, to get a suspect and charge a suspect?
Well, what I've been told so far is 39 years is the longest case, cold case. I think earlier this week there was a 22-year case, but I think I heard someone that there was another case somewhere in the country that was close to 30 years. But we're not competing for any records or anything. But I think a clear message to everyone is, if they have committed some sort of offense of this level of magnitude, that, you know what, you're not, the possibility of you being undetected continues to diminish, that, police, law enforcement throughout the country are not going to stop, and that technology continues to evolve, and we're going to use it to our advantage. I think it's, in the pursuit of justice, and that's what, we all want is justice.
Mm-hmm. With the enormous publicity surrounding this case, it's generated a lot of attention, of course, in Iowa, the Midwest, the nation. Are you still looking for leads, more evidence, testimony that may be uncovered as this goes to trial? People who may have, in the meantime, been close to Jerry Lynn Burns, the charged suspect here.
Yes, absolutely. Mr. VanderSandem indicated Wednesday night, this case still remains an active investigation, and anyone who has additional information, no matter how small or slight they feel it is, we welcome that information. Please contact us here at the Cedar Rapids Police Department. We'd love to take that information and again, provide it to Mr. VanderSandem and the other team of on his prosecution team. And I think with what happened on Wednesday, it maybe some people's memories might be, jogged so that maybe they do remember something. 39 years is a long time, and maybe something that they felt was insequential or not related very well, maybe. So give us a call, give us the information, and let us look into it.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any further leads this week, or can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any, but I have not been into the Detective Bureau yet today, so I'm not aware of any as of right now.
Well, Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German, we're very appreciative of you taking the time to tell us about this remarkable case and the relief that it brings to the family, to the community. Thank you so much for describing what's going on at the Cedar Rapids Police Department with this case. Chief Wayne German, thank you so much.
Well, Ben, thank you very much for having me and allowing me to have the opportunity to provide you and your listeners with this information. We really appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, Obamacare enrollment slips here in Iowa, but not as much as supporters of the ACA had feared. I'll talk with Tony Lays of the Des Moines Register. Also, two Iowa middle schools requiring their students in the spring to take a gun safety course. I'll talk with the superintendent of those schools after we take this break. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back with more of a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, two Iowa middle schools, we heard this week, will require their students to take a gun safety course this spring. We'll talk with the superintendent of those two Iowa middle schools in just a moment. But first, a couple of items of health news to catch up on. Tony Lays joins us, Des Moines Register health reporter. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
Looking at your reporting this week, wanted to have you comment on a couple of stories. Affordable Care Act enrollment. You reported the number of Iowans signing up for private health insurance under what is also known as Obamacare slipped this fall, but not as much as the program's fans feared. Give us some details.
Well, almost 50,000 Iowans signed up for what are called individual health insurance policies under the Affordable Care Act. And those are the policies that people don't, if they don't have access to employer-provided insurance or if they're not eligible for Medicare or Medicaid, that's pretty much their only choice. And there was concern that it would fall significantly this year from last year's 53,000 folks who signed up for 2018 insurance this way, because they heard that the Affordable Care Act was a failure and that it was going to be repealed, and also that there was not much marketing this year. There was a very short open enrollment period, and the government got rid of a program called the Navigator Program that helped people sign up for these policies. So there was fear that the enrollment would really fall off, and it fell off a little, but not as much as some folks had worried it would.
In other words, there was a lot of headwind that had actually can be traced back to actions of the Trump administration.
Yes, largely because of that. Mm-hmm. It's important to know that this is a fairly small slice of Iowans. Way more people get employer-provided insurance than this kind, but these are the people who are most vulnerable to instability in the market because they don't have solider options.
Mm-hmm. What is the significance of that, that it wasn't as bad as the program's fans feared?
It's a little hard to tell. These are early numbers that we don't know exactly who they are. In previous years and presumably in this year, it's mostly people who have low enough incomes that they qualify for substantial subsidies under the Affordable Care Act to help pay their premiums. That for a single person, that would be somebody making between $12,000 and $48,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the bombshell court ruling last Friday on the ACA. This is a health care act twice sustained by the Supreme Court. We had a federal mm-hmm. judge in Texas, I believe, ruling last Friday that it is not constitutional.
The entire law is not constitutional. It's hard to know what the future is going to hold with that. It obviously is going to work its way up to the appeals court and probably the Supreme Court. If the entire law got thrown out, that would be a huge deal. In Iowa, the most prominent effect would be the 160,000 poor adults who gained Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Most of those folks used to be uninsured. And if that coverage was suddenly in jeopardy, that would be a very big deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, you reported on this week, Tony Lays, a lawsuit where hundreds of Central Iowa urology patients have been prevented from seeing their chosen physicians since their doctors were fired by the Iowa Clinic in September. Tell us about this story.
So the Iowa Clinic is the main specialty group for medical practice in central Iowa, and they are in a business dispute with their urologists. They're saying that some of the urologists were trying to split off and set up their own practice, and the board fired 3 of the 10 urologists in the practice, and then 5 of the remaining 7 have tendered their resignations but are continuing to work. But the reason this was a story is because of the effect of on the patients. The Iowa Clinic invoked a non-compete clause on the 3 doctors it fired, and that means they can't practice in central Iowa for a year. And they've been told they can't have any contact with their patients. And there were apparently a few patients who literally had undergone that surgery that day. And when they came to from the surgery, were told their surgeon was no longer with the Iowa Clinic and they'd have to be set up with a different doctor.
Hmm. Wow. How does this go forward? What are you watching?
Well, like I said, it's a business dispute. We'll have to see how it gets settled. Certainly the pressure is on the Iowa Clinic to settle with at least the doctors they still have remaining. They say they're bringing in new help and that no patients will go without care. But if you need this kind of treatment, I'm hearing that there's already delays in getting in to see a doctor because of this dispute. And if it worsens, that will worsen.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. And some of these are cancer patients, prostate cancer mainly.
Tony, going forward into the holiday season, what else do you have your eyes on before we say goodbye?
Well, we'll have to see. In Iowa, the big story the last couple of years has been the privatization of Medicaid. The governor has said that she is intent on making it work better, but she supports it, so it's not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see how they address some of the complaints of from both patients and from care providers about how that's been going in the first couple of years. That'll be the main story we're looking at in healthcare in Iowa.
Right, and the next session of the Iowa legislature dealing with that, you believe?
There will be some issues to deal with it. A lot of it will be the governor's office has a lot of authority on its own to make changes. We'll also be looking at there is an expansion of mental health services that was called for in a bill last spring. They're trying to implement that now, and it's going to be interesting to see how that gets implemented and whether folks actually have more access to care because of it.
Okay. Tony Lays, Des Moines Register health reporter, thank you for getting us up to date and all the great reporting, Tony, and happy holidays.
You too. Thanks for the opportunity, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the curriculum at Iowa's public schools, of course, changes over the years. Certain courses added, other courses dropped. But what about making a course in gun safety mandatory in public schools? Well, two rural Iowa school districts are doing just that. Students from the Clarksville and North Butler school districts, they are located in rural north central Iowa, will learn how to safely handle a gun during a physical education course focusing on hunter safety. We're joined now by the superintendent for both districts, Joel Foster. Superintendent Foster, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate your time.
Why make this requirement now?
Well, first off, I'm not real sure how the term mandatory ever got pinned to this. We've always, from the beginning, stated that it is going to be something that parents have the opportunity to opt their kids out if they have a strong objection. But, you know, we live in small rural communities, and there are a lot of firearms. A lot of our kids do hunt and have access to those things, and we just think that it's better for us to have them trained in a proper way than to learn it on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any firearms incidents in your communities that have prompted this also?
Actually, you know, we did have a young man who was a victim of an accidental shooting last May in the Clarksville district.
Was that hunting related?
It was not. It was just a mishap due to somebody not understanding the firearm that they had brought with them.
Mm-hmm. How have students reacted to this, students and parents?
You know, all the reaction within our communities has been positive. They think it's a good thing. You know, a lot of kids nowadays, their only exposure to any type of weapons is through video games, and to that, you know, to them it's just a game. And they think that, you know, okay, we shoot somebody, they respawn on the other side of the map, and we go again. And that's not the case. Everything that happens with the firearm is final.
Mm-hmm. Is this in any way a way to promote gun rights?
Oh, absolutely not. It has nothing to do with gun rights. It has to do with teaching our kids how to be safe if the opportunity ever arises where they need to know how to handle something. You know, and it's not necessarily that all our kids are going to hunt, or do we expect them to. But we have a lot of young kids, boys and girls both, who babysit in our communities. And if they're babysitting someone and a young child walks out of mom and dad's room because they don't have a firearm locked up, I would like for them to be able to know how to handle that situation and make sure that the weapon is unloaded or that they can unload it and put it away safely.
Mm. Have you nevertheless received any pushback from anti or gun control activists?
The only two negative things I have gotten, I've gotten an email from Australia and an email from Canada that were negative, and they have completely misunderstood the point, because the one from Canada was talking about teaching the kids how to massacre animals, and that couldn't be the farthest thing from our minds. You know,
mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that our kids are safe, and our job is to educate the kids in our community to meet the needs of our community. And this is one of the needs that we see within our community.
Superintendent Foster, I wonder if you could describe, from what you know, it's a week of instruction, right? This doesn't go a whole semester long. Can you describe the instruction that will be given to these middle schoolers?
It's basically the same class that you could take anywhere that the DNR has a hunter safety course. It's going to be presented by the Butler County Conservation Naturalist, Steve Martin, and the Department of Natural Resources. And, you know, they'll go through the safety. They'll go through outdoor ethics, how to do things the right way.
Is there a shooting range at some point? Is there any live ammo at any point?
There is not. Any firearms that are used will be disabled, and any ammunition will just be dummy ammunition. There's never a point where the kids will be asked to fire a weapon.
Okay. So you said the word mandatory got into this story mistakenly. Parents can opt out of this course for their children. Have any parents opted out?
No.
Any questions about that? Yeah, we'll find out that later, huh?
Yeah, the notes will go home after Christmas. The course will happen at North Butler. It'll start towards the end of February, 1st of March, and then it'll probably be a week or so after that at Clarksville. But then there will also be optional class in the evening for kids that are of the ages that aren't involved in the class in the PE curriculum.
Mm-hmm. You told the Des Moines Register that you hope the course will prepare students to react in the event of an active shooter situation. Can you describe a scenario where gun safety skills could be helpful in that situation?
Well, any time that you have an active shooter, there's a lot of things going on. But, you know, if by some chance there's an active shooter and they drop their weapon, maybe we have a young person that could get that weapon, move it away, unload it, so it's no longer a danger.
Mm-hmm. And that's
you know, and what we teach our kids is if something like that does happen, then you either throw it in a garbage can or cover it with a garbage can so the weapon's not visible.
So part of this safety session will be what if there is an active shooter and what if you happen to get a hold of one of his or her firearms?
Not necessarily. That's a whole different training that we do with our staff as far as active shooter scenarios. You know, we are required by law now to do those types of drills, lockdown drills, and those types of things. And that would be more of a part of that. We use the ALICE training here, so that's a part of that training.
Mm-hmm. Are kids generally on their minds, the active shooters in your schools?
I think it's on all kids' minds. You know, it's our responsibility to keep kids safe, and the things that have happened across the country, you know, it's always there for kids. They're always thinking about those things. It's in the news just about every day.
Right. Has this been in the national news? Has national news contacted you about this training?
I have had contact from National Public Radio for the show The Takeaway on there. And, you know, give them my 2 cents worth on that. And I do know that it's been picked up by some other sources and run there, too.
Okay. We want to leave it there then. Joel Foster, superintendent for the school districts of Clarksville and North Butler in north central Iowa. Thank you for explaining this to us, Superintendent.
No problem. Anytime, Ben. I appreciate your time.
Okay. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. 'Tis the season of giving. Unfortunately, it is also the season of scamming and fraud. So we thought it would be a good idea to listen back to a conversation I had back in August with the Iowa Attorney General's office with Lynn Hicks. He's their communications director. The reason for our conversation back then, the uptick in pesky robocalls many of us are getting with increasing frequency. Who is doing this to us? What evil overlord?
That's right. Well, they're coming from all over. And unfortunately, a lot of them are coming from overseas, which limits our ability and limits our national officials' ability to crack down on this. Mm-hmm. But yes, they are. That's what Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller calls these the bane of our existence. So we're all frustrated about it.
They can range from, well, at best, they're just disturbances, annoying disturbances, maybe about a mortgage, refinancing your mortgage or whatever. But they can be that can be the guise for a scam. They could be costly financial scams. I want to play a couple examples, Lynn, to have your reaction to that, get your advice. This is an IRS scam that many of our listeners will recognize. Have you got a call like this before?
To inform you that IRS is filing lawsuit against you. To get more information about this case file, please call immediately on our department number 202-470-2565.
Okay, you're supposed to hang up. Don't do what they said. But here's a clip from a YouTube vlogger, V Westlife, who actually called back that number that the scammer gave in the voice message. And here's what he heard when he called that number.
Thank you for calling Internal Revenue Service, Criminal Investigation Division. All officers are busy right now. Please leave us your name, last four of your social, and the best contact number to reach you. And the consent officer of your case will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you.
Yeah, that sure didn't sound like the IRS to me. You notice they asked for part of your social security number. Can you say identity theft?
Yes, we can. V Westlife, the vlogger there, Lynn Hicks. So they're fishing for information, right? If you would call back and give that information, what would happen?
Yes. Yes, do not call back. And unfortunately, we continue to get a lot of complaints about the IRS scam. You'll notice the 202. So it seems legitimate. You may be getting a call that is spoofed. The number is spoofed, so it, you know, it appears to be coming from Washington, D.C. So, first of all, don't call back. When you get a call like this, the IRS is not going to call you, first of all, like this. Second of all, hang up as immediately as possible. Do not answer any questions. Do not give out any Social Security numbers. Don't even, sometimes you'll get a call that says to prevent getting any more calls, press 2 or something like that. Don't press 2 because that tells the robocaller that you're a legitimate target. So just hang up.
Right, right. Anything you do, they're like, it really is just like fishing out there. They've got their line in the water. They got thousands, millions of lines out there. And if you press a number, say something, they know they got some, you've reacted to the bait.
That's correct.
What is being done about this at a federal level, at a state level, at your attorney general's office level, by Congress?
That's right. Well, this is the top consumer complaint for many law enforcement, for the FCC, for us. And FCC is, they've started cracking down and doing millions of dollars in enforcement actions. They recently had a $120 million fine against a man in Florida. They've changed some rules. We were part of a group of attorney generals who wrote them and said, advocated changing some of the rules to allow phone companies to block certain types of these calls so they don't reach consumers. The FCC agreed on that. We've another thing that the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, is doing is it's empowering companies to come up with blocking technology. Mm-hmm. There's a website out there that I would point to. It's called nomorobo.com. nomorobo.com. And that is essentially an app that you can have on your cell phone that will screen, you know, it has different settings, but it can screen or block some of these calls. And it's all an attempt to kind of stay one step ahead of the scammers, but that's really hard. So that's some of the things that the FCC is and the FTC is doing.
Okay, Lynn Hicks, thank you for bringing us up to date on the robocalls, spoofing, as you said. Communications Director for the Iowa Attorney General, Lynn Hicks. Thank you. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, this is our final News Buzz for 2018. We, of course, want to check in with IPR Studio One to help us not only groove into the weekend, but also groove into the holidays and perhaps get us in the right mindset to meet 2019. Tony Daner of IPR Studio One, Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Did I set that up right, the right mindset for 2019? Who knows what the right mindset is, right?
That's right. And but, you know, good music is always going to be there to keep you company, and it's a good friend to have, well, any time, but, you know, especially at this time of year, I think.
Okay, so what have you got to groove us into the weekend today?
Well, this is not so much new music, but what the heck. It's going to be new to a lot of us. Fleet Foxes, a band that is probably going to be familiar to a lot of Studio One listeners, have a new box set. It's called First Collection 2006 to 2009. It includes the classic self-titled debut album, also their first two EPs, And there is a disc of B-sides and rarities. And as with a lot of B-sides and rarities that we get from these artists, you listen to the song and you're kind of like, wow, this is one of the songs that they rejected. That's pretty incredible because I never would have come up with this in a million years. This song that we're going to hear, this is lead singer Robin Pecknold just playing on an acoustic guitar. You're going to hear some ambient room noise because he's probably kind of far away from whatever device he is using to record. It's called White Lace Regretfully. This is Fleet Foxes.
Okay, Tony Danner, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Ben. Happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
And to you. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.